Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal. I have the pleasure today of speaking with a pair of colleagues from Michigan State University. Karen Kelly Blake is in the Center for Ethics and Humanities in the Life Sciences and the Department of Medicine. And Libby Bogdan-Lovis is in the same center where she works as assistant director. We're going to be talking today about a paper they have coming out in the September issue of Medical Education 2018. The title being Rationales for Expanding Minority Physician Representation in the Workforce, Scoping Review. Thank you both for being present, and I'll do my best to coordinate a three-way conversation.
Thank you.
It makes it easier that you're both in the same room and have the joy of summer upon you, as I understand it. This paper I was very intrigued by for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons I want to have the opportunity to talk with you is it seems like a very good example of taking a concept like the value that we often implicitly place in building up minority physician representation and more deliberately unpacking the rationales or the reasons for doing that, as the title implies. Can I ask one of you to begin by just explaining why you thought that was necessary, given that hopefully we're at least moving in a direction where more and more people understand the value of this sort of activity?
Thanks. We started because it got our attention when we looked at some of the reports that had come out after 2000. There were about 10 major reports that came out that argued for the need to increase underrepresented minority representation in medical education and ultimately in medicine. And along with those reports, there's a common refrain that we started to pay attention to just in a casual way. And that was that it was commonly linked with the notion that underrepresented minority physicians do a good job of providing care to vulnerable populations.
Yes, and we agree that there is some advantage to providing a physician workforce that mirrors the general patient population. And we agree that it is, you know, the right thing to do to have this sort of diverse health professional workforce. But one of the things we were wondering about was what sort of were the future costs for underrepresented minority physicians? What might be the disadvantages to sort of being singled out, perhaps tracked, perhaps even sort of streamed into these particular areas of service, which were to serve the vulnerable and low resource communities?
Right. I definitely want to come back to that issue of the future implications. Can I ask one of you first to elaborate a little bit on those reports in terms of how are they defining vulnerable populations? Was it simply a link to the same unrepresented minority groups, or was vulnerable a bit more broadly considered?
Well, I think in general, they really were focusing on the sort of broad spectrum of health disparities that exists here in the United States. They do primarily focus on poor communities, low resource communities, whether those be urban or rural. That is sort of the general tenor of what is meant by vulnerable and underserved populations.
Thank you. And for those who are listening who aren't in the States, how would you describe the current state in terms of what groups are underrepresented, what groups were particularly focused upon in your efforts to conduct this review?
So these would be groups historically marginalized in the U.S., so that would be predominantly non-white populations. We're talking about African Americans, we're talking about Native Americans, Latina and Latino populations here in the U.S. We would be talking about migrant workers. We would be talking about poor people who live in rural areas. Did I miss anything, Libby?
No, that's good.
Okay.
And is this a particular focus in the Center for Bioethics where the two of you work, or is it something that you as individuals were trying to bring to the center?
In the curricular work that we do, Karen and I both focus on social determinants of health. So we're responsible for what's called social context of clinical decisions within the medical curriculum. And that includes ethics and health policy, shared decision making, social determinants of health, and a little bit on research ethics as well.
Great, thank you. And so with that as some context and clear representation of the problem that you were trying to address, again, scoping reviews are becoming increasingly popular in the field, but I suspect there are a lot of people who don't really appreciate what differentiates a scoping review from a systematic review or from a critical review or something else. So what would you define as the key features of the effort that you made in trying to address this research question?
So a scoping review allows us to really review a broader scope of literature. It casts a wide net. It includes peer-reviewed literature as well as policy white papers, conference proceedings, and special reports. One of the advantages is that we're not limited by the requirements of a systematic review where you have this sort of narrow, defined research question. You are really looking at the rigor of those articles that you're including in the systematic review. We don't really have that limitation with a scoping review. It really does allow us to look at such a wide variety of possible literature that we can include and perhaps then identify those things as being relevant to us, selecting those things, and being able to collate, summarize, and report the results.
And look at trends within the literature.
And were there any particular challenges or hurdles that you found needed to be overcome in this particular instance?
Probably timing. It takes time, and we really did this without having any funding. Right. So we really were depending on volunteer work from our collaborators and also our students who acted as our research assistants. But it really is quite a detailed, comprehensive process. So I don't want people to get the idea that somehow it is less than, it's just different than a systematic review. And I might also add, it is an enterprise that we could not have done and done as well as we did without the help of our medical school librarian here at Michigan State University at the College of Human Medicine, Miss Iris Kovar-Goff. She was excellent.
Wonderful. So great to have somebody like that working with you on things like this. And I would certainly reinforce your statement that scoping and systematic aren't different in terms of one being better than another. They're truly just different and for different purposes. And I guess what I was wondering was if you found it challenging, given the breadth of the issue that you were trying to deal with, to keep your scope defined, or was there any particular feature of the decisions you made in terms of what to include that would be important for somebody to know to interpret your results?
Yeah, so one of the things that happened is that we really, when we were defining underrepresented minorities, we focused primarily on Native Americans, African Americans, and Latino and Latinas. That meant that we had to exclude a whole host of other people, so like Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. We found such a dearth in the literature that we just decided that although it would be important to understand that they too fit in this definition of underrepresented minorities in medicine, there's really not a lot of information in the literature about this particular group of medical students. So we made a decision not to include that particular group of people. We also made the decision not to include the whole kind of breadth of the health professional workforce. So, you know, we made a strategic decision not to include dental students, not to include pharmacy students, not to include nursing students, because we believe that the issues that we raise here in our paper probably cross those professions as well. But we made the decision not to include them.
So since we have a team of scholars working on this, we met weekly using Skype, actually. And so I'd like to mention the work of our colleagues also, Nanibag Garrison, who's assistant professor, Department of Pediatrics, Division of Bioethics as well at University of Washington, Seattle, and Faith Fletcher, who is in the Department of Health Behavior, University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Public Health. At the time we were working with her, she was at University of Illinois in Chicago. And Brittany Ajegba is a College of Human Medicine medical student here at Michigan State University. Cole Smith, was an undergraduate student at the time at Vanderbilt. She's now a medical student at University of Chicago. And Morgan Bradford, who was an undergraduate anthropology student. And we met weekly with Skype, and there were certain things we struggled with. One was the term concordance. So we started off in casual conversation with each other about this notion of concordance. And as Karen talks about it, it boils down to like. There's an assumption that if someone looks or sounds like another person, that there's something shared there. And so our initial search was just casting a very wide net, looking at the notion of concordance going through the literature. And then we struggled among ourselves, trying to define exactly what that means, came up with a code book and settled on a definition. But that was a struggle.
Yeah. And so one of the other things we decided on, we made a strategic decision that for concordance, we really were talking about a sort of visual identity matching, a race, ethnic, shared identity, as opposed to looking across all kinds of identities that people hold. So we didn't look at gender, we didn't look at sexual orientation, we didn't look at language, we didn't look at geographic area, rural, urban. So we narrowly defined what our scope was going to be to sort of constrain the process.
Right. And as you talk about concordance, now you start thinking about the variety of rationales that you encountered, you know, concordance and workforce diversity and maintaining physician-patient relationship and service commitment. Were you, first of all, surprised by the variety of rationales that were out there? And maybe more importantly, did you get any sense as to why particular rationales might be put forward in particular circumstances? Or did it seem just a bit more random based on whatever a particular author happened to choose?
Well, I don't think we were surprised by the rationales, because working in a medical school is not unusual to hear these things just sort of in the everyday sort of vernacular that happens when talking with colleagues and being in a medical student environment. So the rationale that was most often cited in the literature was patient-physician relationship, which dovetailed with this idea of like-to-like matching, service commitment, as well, huge in the literature about what it means to serve the underserved, to serve vulnerable populations where they are, the educational benefit of having a more diverse medical workforce and what that means, community benefit, how there's this sort of societal benefit for making sure that we have the workforce in place to serve a vast majority of patients that live in low resource and poor areas, and how it's important to make sure that they have the same access and quality of care that anyone else has. I think one of the things too, the social justice argument, this argument that encouraging the inclusion of underrepresented minorities in some way acts to sort of mediate past historical wrongs and discrimination that has happened here in the United States.
And that effort and a couple of other things you said do take my head towards the implications in terms of what the future longer term goal or outcome might be, dependent on which particular rationale somebody adopts. You started to allude earlier to the notion that there might be unintended consequences of adopting a particular rationale. I wonder if I could ask you now to explain some of your thoughts as to where this might lead us and whether or not there might be any challenges that are created by virtue of adopting one rationale relative to another.
The rationale that certainly saw an increase over time was the notion of, I'm going to cite from one of the reports that I mentioned earlier, is titled "The Right Thing to Do, the Smart Thing to Do." And we certainly agree that increasing underrepresented minorities in undergraduate medical education is the right thing to do. What's interesting is that the smart thing to do is referring to the justification, and the justification is because presumably, you will then have more underrepresented minorities who are physicians who will take care of the needs of the underserved. And that leads to an argument of what we term as instrumentalism, that the reason that you're increasing underrepresented minorities in medicine is so that they will go to their communities, supposedly, and take care of their own, quote unquote. and it doesn't examine or pay attention to the range of diversity of underrepresented minorities who are in medicine, who may or may not have anything in common with underserved communities. But it also then pigeonholes them and limits their professional careers, their professional futures, in very subtle but certain ways.
Yes, so some of those ways might be you may not have access to the specialty training that your other peers might have. You may not have access to the other professional leadership opportunities that your peers might have, because if the expectation is for you to be a physician serving in a low-resource community, the burden really is on you to provide a lot of care, and particularly primary care, to a lot of sick people. So then you're also at a disadvantage with the way healthcare is being reimagined in the United States and how it's about value-based, it's about patient satisfaction surveys, it's about you sort of being reimbursed based on these sort of healthcare quality measures that you're supposed to achieve with your patient population. So if you are an underrepresented minority physician working in a low resource community with the poorest and the sickest of us, then your ability to get reimbursed at the same rates as your peers is already limited and constrained in a way that we would argue is unfair.
And let me add one other thing, and that is the expectation that we see articulated so often in the literature that is placed on underrepresented minority healthcare providers is not placed in the same way what I sometimes refer to as their well-represented peers. Mm-hmm. And my colleague Karen often corrects me and says it's the white students, basically. It's the majority students. Mm-hmm. Don't have that same expectation placed on them. So their career, their futures are wide open in some ways. Whereas for underrepresented minorities, it's this unarticulated but certain expectation that is layered on top of other expectations.
Thank you both and the rest of your colleagues for bringing these things to light. They are such insightful and important observations, and the details we obviously don't have time to go into in their entirety, but I will just sort of wrap up and encourage listeners to go look at the paper by quoting your final sentence of your abstract. Our findings suggest that the expanding emphasis on underrepresented minority service commitment warrants ongoing scrutiny and is a cautionary tale regarding unintended consequences for medical educators globally. It's a very powerful statement that clearly needs to be attended to, and I'll end by congratulating you on the work and pursuing this cause.
Thank you so much for having us, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Just so that you can find it, the paper again is entitled Rationales for Expanding Minority Physician Representation in the Workforce, Scoping Review. You'll find it in the September 2018 issue, and the authors you've been listening to are Karen Kelly Blake and Libby Bogdan-Lovis. Mm-hmm.